JAXA Space and Astronautical Science Podcast.
Welcome to the JAXA Space and Astronautical Science Podcast. I'm your host, Toshihisa Mikaido. Today we talk with X-ray astronomer Yu Zhou about using X-ray diffuse images to search for matter in the galaxy, local hot bubbles and dark matter halos, the warm hot intergalactic medium, the light bird, cryogenic detectors, and other fairly complex scientific topics. We also discuss her time in China, America, and Japan, and what tools she thinks could be useful for anyone interested in X-ray astronomy who wants to take part. Please enjoy. Our guest today from JAXA's Institute of Space and Astronautical Science, X-ray astronomer Yu Zhou. Yu, welcome to the show.
Hi, Nikaido-san. Thank you very much for having me here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for being here.
Very much for inviting me.
I'd just like to start off the episode by asking the guest what it is that you're currently doing at JAXA.
Yes, I'm currently a project researcher at JAXA ISS. My data analysis work is mainly on the X-ray astronomy. Specifically, it is on the diffuse X-ray background. Just for your information, the background is not just a background on a detector. It is actually containing multiple sources. For example, when people firstly have the chance to look into the X-ray sky since probably 1960s, people found X-ray emission is full of the space, and we don't fully understand what that is. But as the technology improves, now we have much better X-ray satellites like Chandra or XMM Newton that with the very, very high spatial resolution, they find the diffuse X-ray source is not just diffuse, and most of them can be resolved in discrete sources. Like they're actually point source, but previously was not resolved by the detector because of the poor resolution. And those point source can be very distant galaxies, and they can also be coming from the active galactic nuclei. And those what we call AGN, is actually supermassive black holes. Usually their mass is about maybe 1 million times solar mass.
And that's 1 million times the sun, right?
Right. So they can create very huge amount of matter around its orbital and form an accretion disk that emit X-ray emission. They also emit optical and radio emissions, but in X-rays, we are observing the hotter part. So for the galaxies and also gas clusters, there's actually hot gas. They're truly diffuse, but because they're trapped in the gravitational potential of that dark matter halo. So from very distant place, when you're observing them from the Earth, they're surrounding those galaxies, but somewhat more extended. And that's the distant source. Actually, because we are actually sitting inside the Milky Way. Milky Way is also a galaxy. So you can imagine we also have dark matter halo around us, and we're actually sitting inside it. So there are also hot gas inside the galactic halo, and they are truly diffuse. And because we're inside it, we cannot avoid observing them. But they're really, really diffuse, so that when we look through them by only a very narrow window, that is our detector, it looks just like a diffuse background, right? And that is kind of a middle band source of the diffuse X-ray source. And if you move even closer to us inside our solar system, we have a very different type of diffuse source as well, that is called local hot bubble. So this kind of local hot bubble is still under exploration, but we believe that long time ago, there was once a huge supernova explosion near the solar system, and it has created a big local cavity that has enveloped our solar system. And inside this local cavity, there might be full of the hot gas, about 1 million Kelvin. So they do also created a lot of soft diffuse X-ray emission. So you can imagine a lot of different sources. They all create a X-ray signal and they overlap with each other on our detector plane. A little bit difference is that the temperature of the local hot bubble is a little bit lower than the temperature of the diffuse hot gas inside the Milky Way. The hot gas inside the Milky Way will tend to have 2 million hot Kelvin hot gas. They create stronger peak for oxygen 7 line that will peak around 500 EV or 700 EV. And the local hot bubble have a lower temperature, so that their peak on the energy spectrum is about maybe below 300 EV. Yeah, that's kind of, sorry, I'm trying to continue too long. And that is the kind of the constant source. Sometimes we see transient source inside the solar system as well. That is coming from the solar wind. So the solar is quite active, right? Sometimes it creates a lot of hot ions. And those when these ions traveled onto the Earth and interact with the neutrons inside the Earth's atmosphere, it will create some non-thermal emission via the charge exchange process. So it creates significant lines whenever you have a very strong solar wind that can really heavily contaminate the spectrum if our target is local hot bubble or the galactic halo. And actually, I'm looking for a very, very faint signal that is actually different from any of the source I have mentioned. I'm looking for a signal from the missing baryons inside our universe. So let me introduce a little bit about this missing baryon problem. This is also a big topic. So...
Okay. I guess but before you get into the missing variants, sounds very interesting. Maybe we should unpack a little bit of the information you've already gone over. It sounds like definitely you're looking at a lot of complex information, but just going way back to the diffuse images that you get from X-ray satellites.
So currently the satellite I'm using is Suzaku.
Suzaku, okay. And just to get an idea for anybody who might not know what these diffuse images actually look like, are they sort of like black and white, sort of cloudy photographs that you end up getting, or how do these look? How would you describe them to someone who's, let's say someone's never seen one before?
Right. I think the amazing part is that the background looks like blank, just looks like there's nothing. I'm removing any kind of resolvable source out of my field of view, and I only focusing on the part of the sky looks really dark and black.
So it's usually just a black and white photograph.
Yes, the background.
Mm-hmm. And then you will have to sort of go through this and try and figure out what each part of the photograph would be. Then.
Yes, even though they look black in the image, but they contain very rich information for all type of source I have mentioned. So we can look into the images by two different ways. One is the energy spectrum. So as I said, so those X-ray photons have a different energy distribution. So the detector itself have a different energy channel ranging from 200 EV to 10 keV.
Can you explain what EV is? What kind of measurement?
EV is the energy to accelerate one electrons to one volt.
And how would this, or how would it be different in terms of what you are looking for in this case? Like a higher EV versus a lower EV?
Okay, higher EV is higher energy and a shorter wavelength. You can imagine in terms of the colors. Okay, for red color, mm-hmm. it is longer wavelength compared mm-hmm. to purple. Red color has lower energy. Purple has higher energy. And infrared, which is about the body temperature mm-hmm. from you. So you're emitting at a wavelength longer than the red color. And X-ray emit a wavelength shorter than the purple, higher energy band than the optical light. If you are comparing with EV denoted detectors, like compared to gamma ray detector, the X-ray detector has a lower EV range.
So I think we have a slightly better understanding of what's going on here. And it looks like you're really looking for a lot of different things within the images that you get. One thing that you did mention there, you said there's a dark matter halo around the Milky Way. Is this
yes.
something that can be detected in some way? Or is this a theoretical idea? Or how do you know about the dark matter halo around the Milky Way?
That is a very good question, actually, because for people to realize there's a dark matter is actually from this kind of galaxy matter measurement. So when people are starting to measure the matter for a galaxy, they measure the velocity of the stars moving around the galaxy. So as I told you, each galaxy at the center, they have a black hole, right? So we can measure the mass of the black hole by the velocity rotating around the black hole. And the big problem is that as scientists are measuring the velocity, the rotation velocity of the stars further from the center of a galaxy, they find this rotation curve have indicated a higher dark matter mass compared with the central black hole mass. That means there must be some mass creating this gravitational potential to make the stars rotating at a velocity as high as it was observed. That's how people start to realize there's some matter that we cannot see. Beginning with that, people realize maybe there's dark matter.
Thank you. Yeah, we really went over a lot.
Yeah, it's hard to explain the astronomy. Very complicated. And I actually have deviated from my story because I just explained the X-ray, the energy spectrum.
No, it's no problem. I was just wondering if you could also sort of describe these the local hot bubbles that you were talking about earlier in a little bit more detail.
Okay.
So I think that might be confusing also to just hearing a local hot bubble.
Okay. So as I said, people thought there is a hot cavity. There is a local cavity surrounding us.
What do you mean by cavity here?
The cavity is that we didn't find enough neutral hydrogen as high as it is inside our Milky Way. So the most direct evidence, the observational evidence for the local cavity is that first we find there's soft X-ray emission surrounding us, and that is completely diffusive. Then if this soft X-ray emission is caused by absorption, for example, if there's neutral hydrogen surrounding us, they can create more like softer energy spectrum. But we have also measured the column density of the neutral hydrogen, and we try to study the correlation between the soft X-ray emission and the column density of the neutral hydrogen. And we found that it's not a correlation, but kind of anti-correlation. So it means more soft X-rays, less neutral hydrogen. So a local hot bubble can explain that, because if you imagine there's a local cavity around us, so when you look through one line of sight, if you have longer path of the cavity, you got more soft X-ray emission. And if you got longer path of cavity, you also get less neutral hydrogen.
And based on the length of the path, you
yes, based on the
sort of theorize how much neutral hydrogen will be in any specific area?
Yes. Yes. So people also try to map the length of the cavity by different tracers. And so we know it's local, but not from a very distant place because of some shadow experiment. So if you look onto a shadow of a cloud, you see there's still this soft X-ray emission. That means the soft X-ray emission is really local. Because we know the position, we know the location of that cloud is very close. It's only like several parsec from the solar system. And if this soft X-ray emission is very far away from us, say if it is outside of our Milky Way, then the soft X-ray emission will be blocked by that cloud. But if you just look at that cloud, you still see the soft X-ray emission part. So that means it is really local and it's very close to us.
So you judge the distance based on the data that you get from the X-ray emissions then? Or yes. Sorry, from the soft X-ray.
Yeah, that is from the soft X-ray only. But we also have other evidence from the optical band, because say the latest research on the local hot bubble is given by Gaia, which is the most advanced star survey. So they do resolve a lot of stars around this local cavity. So that has supported the evidence found from the X-ray band, that maybe there's really a local bubble.
Before I cut you off, before you were about to go into explain the missing variance.
Yeah. The missing variance is another very big topic. So as you know from the cosmology that is well accepted by the scientific community right now, that our universe has 70% dark energy and 25% dark matter, and 5% is baryons. Baryons is the normal matter that can create the electromagnetic wave. So people have measured the fraction of the normal baryons by different ways, by different method. For example, from the CMB, the cosmic microwave background, they can find a good consistency of that 5% baryons. And also the measurement from the supernova, they can measure the fraction of the baryons in a later universe, like from redshift of maybe 2 or 3. And they also give a very consistent measure of the baryons. Also, there's evidence from nuclear synthesis. But locally, if we just count the baryons by the stars or cold gas or hot gas inside the galaxies, we couldn't find at least half or one third of the baryons. So that means still some fraction of the baryons was not observed. And one possibility is that they have these missing baryons have a high temperature like 1 million Kelvin. That is in the soft X-ray band. But because our detection tools are not sensitive enough to see them, we find maybe there's a missing baryon problems. So people are still trying to make more and more sensitive detectors to look for this warm-hot, we call it warm-hot intergalactic medium to explain this missing baryon problem. So actually for the next generation X-ray satellite JAXA we're going to launch, I think they're also trying to look for these signals, but I'm not 100% sure. They can cover a lot of different topics on the baryons recycling inside the galactic cluster. But certainly this warm hot intergalactic medium will be a very interesting topic. And so people try to look from many different ways trying to identify this missing baryon problem. And that would be very important for the cosmology.
Is there a simple reason why it's believed that the missing baryons, the part of this, I guess, 5% of normal matter that they can't find, that this they don't think that it's just more dark matter or dark energy?
Yeah, because of the consistency from the other measurement, because of the CMB measurement and supernova remnant have all confirmed the composition of the dark matter and dark energy. And we do have some hints that from the numerical simulation, people are expecting those hot gas was shock heated to a very high temperature. And that is what we expected for the warm hot intergalactic medium.
So according to the current best data that we have on it, there should be, you said about we've only been able to detect about one third of it?
Yeah, perhaps half or two thirds.
And half one third. Okay, anything? Somewhere around half.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
And I guess part of what you're doing is also trying to find some of this missing variance within the diffused images that you look through.
Yes, yes. I'm trying to look for the information for the missing baryons by the spatial analysis of those images, because we believed the warm-hot intergalactic medium is tracing the so-called cosmic web of the universe. And I believed that spatially it will give us a different clustering angular distribution than the point source or the foreground diffuse source. So I did a spatial data analysis of those images to look for the signals.
It sounds like it could be quite a tough job, but quite interesting when you do find something.
Yeah, we did a very tough job on that one. And we didn't find significant signal for the warm-hot intergalactic medium. And that is kind of not surprising because of the limitation of the detector. But in the future, if we have a better detector, we will keep looking for that. And what is meaningful is that by this analysis, we further our understanding of the detector and detector response itself. And that even though it cannot help us to identify the missing baryons, but it will provide us an additional way to analyze and understand the diffuse source. And we now have a better tool to distinguish the unresolved point source from the truly diffuse source. So that's our achievement.
When you have a project like that, how would you actually put together, say, a new project or write a research paper, for example, if you, I guess maybe you have some kind of target in mind or some question that you want to resolve, but what would be the steps that you'd go over to sort of get that research going? Or if there's an existing project, why would you choose one project over another, for example?
Yeah, that's a very important question. And yes, actually, to do a research, one first step is to have, I think one first step is to have a very good question. And then once you have convinced yourself that this question is meaningful to answer, then you need a unique tool. You need a very decent tool to analyze the data. Yes, because we're doing research, you have to make sure that this is something have not been done by anyone else. Even though sometimes the goal is the same, mm-hmm. you have to make sure that this is has something new, or the data is new, or the method is new, or your way of angle is new. You have to make sure you're doing something new that have not been done by anyone else. And then you do it with your full effort. And once you made up your mind, you do not quit, and you have to finish this project until you get the result.
Is there an example of a project or a research paper that you've done recently in your field that where you went over this, you already looked through to make sure that the question was meaningful and that you were doing something new?
Yeah, exactly. The project I have just mentioned, the spatial data analysis about the Suzaku background data.
Did you just release a paper on this?
Yes.
Oh, what's the name of that paper, just in case anybody listening wants to check that out?
Oh, okay. Yes, the name of the paper. Yeah, the name of the paper is Spatial Power Spectral Analysis of the Suzaku X-ray Background.
All right. Anybody listening who has an interest in checking that out, seeing what kind of actual results you'd get from these kinds of papers or these kinds of research questions, maybe go take a look at that.
Yeah, basically what I've just explained.
And do you usually collaborate with a lot of people when you're doing a research paper, or is a lot of it done individually?
It is usually collaborating with limited amount of people.
Limited
for
amount.
For example, this current paper, Spatial Data Analysis with Suzaku Data, is in collaboration with Kazuhisa Mitsuda-san and Noriko Yamazaki-san. They are both JAXA's professors. And actually, Mitsuda-san retired from JAXA 2 years ago, and he moved to NALJ as a project director, I guess. But to collaborate with other people is very important, because as a young scientist, collaborating with a more experienced supervisor may help avoiding you from simple mistake, like, because they have experience and they can help you to know what is just artifacts and what might be wrong from your data analysis. And also, it is always good to have a different mind, because even you are the smartest person in the world, you can make mistakes sometimes. So to check by other people is very important. And of course, for any kind of research work, your purpose is to communicate with the world, with the other people. So it is good, at least from the beginning, you need to convince your collaborators that you have done the good thing. So it is very important.
Speaking of JAXA, and I guess the work that you did there, I kind of want to understand how you got to JAXA in the first place, your career history, maybe even your life history, if you don't mind getting to that, sort of where you were born and raised, where you went to school, and how you ended up at JAXA.
Okay, if we want to talk from since I was born, that is really long, but briefly speaking, I was born in a very small city in Anhui province in China. And my parent, one of them is a math teacher. So I feel quite smooth for my childhood, actually. Also, maybe I'm a quiet person. Most of the time, I just spending time by myself at home and reading books. But somehow I got interested into physics, and I felt incredibly beauty inside of this science. And I went to Tsinghua University for graduate school and also undergraduate school and graduate school. So in there, I met professors majored on the astronomy, and I feel they are really charming person, and they try to teach you to think independently, and they try to give you a very wide background knowledge. And I think astronomy itself is always charming. But my ambitious is actually on physics, but astrophysics is a very good combination. And during my graduate school, I was very lucky to have a 2 years exchange at the US doing the experiment on cryogenic detectors with Dan McCammon, a professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison. And so I met the JAXA's professor, Katsuhisa Mitsuda-san, at one workshop. And at the time, yeah, we were discussing all the fascinating topics about the hot gas, as I just discussed before. And yeah, I'm really excited about that. And I don't know why, but Mitsuda-san find enthusiastic person, and maybe he liked to work with me. So he invited me to work at JAXA for postdoc. It was also at the right time I'm looking for a job. So I think it's really cool because I have heard of Hitomi Satellite Project before I came to Japan, although I don't know too much about Japan, this country, but I know that the Hitomi Satellite and the next coming PRISM Satellite is going to be a very evolutionary X-ray satellite in this world. So I feel quite lucky and absorbed timing down here.
Wow, you were kind of born and raised for this role as an astrophysicist, all the things that you went through. You said that one of your parents was a math teacher?
Right, my dad.
Oh, your dad. And it's actually, I think we're recording this on Father's Day 2022. So maybe after this, send your dad a message.
Yes, I would like to thank my dad. Unfortunately, he don't understand English well.
Okay. But you can thank him directly afterwards. But so when you were young, did he sort of teach you math at a very young age, or how did that work out?
Yeah, that's a very good story to tell, actually. Actually, he did not teach me too much after I was entered into elementary school. But I remember very clearly that when I was like, I don't know how old I was at that time, maybe 5, before I entered elementary school, he tried to teach me how to add up numbers. So he has taught me how to add 1 with 2 equals to 3, and like 5 add with 3 equals to 8. But he has never told me about like 8 times 7 equals to 15, like 1 digit to 2 digit. So okay, he did not told me how, but he asked me the question. And naturally, I don't know. Okay. And he said, okay, go and play. And I forgot about this question. And one day after or 2 days after, he asked me again this question. He said, seven at with eight, how many is the answer? And I said, I don't know, because I have not think about this problem. I have already forgotten the question at all. He did not try to teach me. Okay, he said, okay, go and play. Mm-hmm. And he did not ask me this question. But one day I thought about this question. It just jumped into my mind because he has asked me twice and I don't know the answer. So I think, okay, what is the answer? So suddenly it jumps to my mind. Okay, it's 15, right? So one day, I think he was riding a bicycle. I was sitting on the bicycle and it just occurred to me. And I said, 15, right? And he said, yes, you're right. So yeah, after that, I think I don't really rely on anyone else too much on study after I went to school. And even I don't took classes, I know how to study by myself. And that's what I think my father has always emphasized on my education.
So he would ask you the question, but he wouldn't give you the answer. He wouldn't explain how to do it. He would just make sure that the question lingered in your mind, I guess.
Okay, and I think I remember another very important thing. During, I think one day I was like in the kitchen with my father and mother. I was like 10 years old and I'm like a question machine. Like I want to ask why to every question. So my mother was like losing her patience and I said, stop asking why, there's no why. And but my father stopped my mother and he said it to me, okay, we don't understand why, but stop asking us why. And I think now is your time to ask yourself why that can happen. Hmm. So he didn't stop me asking questions, but he said, I think you can think by yourself. I think that is very important thing in my life, even though he might not realize, but it has an important influence on me. Hmm. So I think really since that I realized, okay, I need to think by myself and whatever questions come up to my mind, I start to think and ask my question to myself.
That sounds like your father instilled a lot of great lessons in you there. It's definitely important to really think about the answers and I guess at the same time, understand that the people around you don't necessarily have all the answers. So again, it's an extra level of importance for you to think for yourself and try and figure out what those answers are and keep asking yourself why.
That has a great impact on me.
And then you said that, I guess around the time you're about to graduate, you met a professor from JAXA who invited you to apply for a postdoc position, or did he invite you directly to the postdoc position?
Apply for? Yes.
Apply for. Okay. So you still have to go through all the regular steps.
Yes.
And so you applied for that and then you got in?
Yes.
And how many years have you been at JAXA now?
3 years.
3 years. Yes. And I think as we've been over in previous episodes with some of our other guests, a lot of contracts in academia are very limited. A lot of the time they are only about 3 years. Are you going to be going somewhere else in the future or how will that work?
Oh, yes. So since the August 1st, I will move to a new institution that is called KEKQUP. So KEK is a big research institution in Japan. Its the full name is called High Energy Accelerator Research Organization. And QUP is actually a new institution, a new international center for quantum field measurement system for studies of the universe and particles in KEK.
Wow, that's really the full name for that. It would be difficult to remember. So.
Yes, but it is, generally speaking, it is a new institution that will focusing on the technology development, and it want to absorb a very wide background. It will integrate particle physics, astrophysics, condensed matter physics, measurement system, and system science. So here, oh, I really like the slogan for this center, which is to bring new eyes to humanity. Yes, and to look at the origins of this beautiful world. Mm-hmm. I guess they want to understand the true nature of time, space, and matter.
That is an interesting slogan. I like that. Will you be doing similar work there that you are at JAXA? Or what will your position be at the new institution?
Okay, the work content will be different. So here at JAXA, I'm mainly working on the X-ray data analysis. But at QUP, I will join the experimental work for the Lightbird project. So
can you explain what the Lightbird project is?
Yeah, the Lightbird project will be the first satellite project that sent the transition edge sensor to the space. And the science target is the cosmic microwave background. It tried to measure the primordial gravitational waves imprinted on the cosmic microwave background.
So with Lightbird, you'd be trying to find things from around the time of the Big Bang?
So I think we want to explore the universe before the Big Bang.
Before the Big Bang.
Yeah, it's quite fancy, but it's quite out of my knowledge scope, so I couldn't understand.
It might be hard to explain in detail what.
Yes, but
how that exactly will go.
You can find that in their website. So my expertise is more on their measuring system, which is called transition edge sensor. I will be testing the measuring system for the Lightbird.
You will be measuring the CMB that they find.
So ultimately, their goal is to observe the CMB. Mm-hmm. But before the satellite is launched, what we are doing at the lab can be multiple purpose. So for example, those detectors are superconducting quantum devices. So I will use those devices to look into some superconducting physics. Also, I have another ambitious plan, but maybe I don't tell you right now.
Okay. I'd be interested to hear. Maybe it will come up later, hopefully. Just a couple months away from starting your new position. Are you excited about that?
Yes, I'm really excited about that. And I do need to prepare for my new job.
JAXA is in Japan, and the new institution with the very lengthy name is also in Japan. You just call it QUP.
Yes.
Okay, is in Japan. So I guess you've spent most of your time since postdoc in Japan.
Yeah.
How do you enjoy Japan, and how do you feel it compares to other countries? Are there any like stark differences that you've noticed, any maybe culture shocks, anything like that?
Yeah. I did went through some culture shock in Japan. Yeah, I'm very, very surprised to learn more about Japan, because basically I know nothing before I came to Japan by myself. And I think the most deep impression about Japan is peace. I think Japan is a really peaceful place that I find it's a real place that everyone enjoy life. So whenever you go on the street, you see a lot of people, they chatting with their friends, they bring their children with their dogs, and especially when there's cherry blossom and everyone would like to go out and see the flowers. And especially I'm very impressed by, the name of their trains and, mm-hmm. the name of their trains like Hope and Light, and some places is named as Stars and Dream. Do you have that impression?
Actually, now that you mention it, yeah, there's just definitely.
Yeah, do you think it's normal in other country?
Probably not to this degree. No, I mean, none that I can think of offhand.
Yeah, so you see, I think Japanese people are really romantic, and especially, yeah, their scientists is really brave. They can dream of very hard directions to look for. Like, they want to chase for dark matter. They want to answer the biggest questions in physics. So I really like, I think Japanese people are really positive, and they are really brave, especially for scientists.
And how would this compare to where you grew up in China, for example?
How does that compare? Is that very hard to compare? Although I think Japan is more open to collaboration. But I don't know if I can say that very in a fair way, because when I was in China, I was just a student. But when I come to Japan, I'm a postdoc. Mm-hmm. So the role is also different. But I do feel in here I can get reach to more different topics, and I get more information that give me a wider acknowledge. Also here, I did met good friends with similar age. I cannot tell which is better or worse, but I think my role was different. Mm-hmm. So I cannot judge very in an objective way.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you've made a lot of friends over here, I guess. Sure.
Not many, but I think because, you know, even at JAXA, they don't have many students or postdocs. On my floor, there's only one other project research shared with the same position as I do. So I don't have many friends here, but I think I found good friends here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially there's some very young professor and project researcher in gravitational wave detector lab. Mm-hmm. And I do enjoy a lot talking with them, and we become very good friends. And, you know, usually talking with the people who share, who doesn't have a similar background with you, is not easy. Mm-hmm. But if you can talk and communicate, that can bring up brilliant ideas, I guess. So I think that's the wonderful part, the best gift I've got after I come to Japan. And I do believe that QUP may provide us with similar or better environment, because the QUP's director wants the place to become a very multicultural background place, and they want to become more international. And he's really nice. He wants this place to become a place that young people can achieve their dreams. So I'm really looking forward to my new position.
Yeah, that sounds great. And I guess it's also good that you have made some really good friends, because I think friendship's definitely one of those areas where you can probably say quality over quantity, right? So.
Yeah.
It's a lot better to have a few really good friends than a lot of terrible friends, let's say. So do you have any notable hobbies and things that you like to do when you're not in the lab?
Yes, I like music. Basically, I like practicing guitar when I'm alone, and sometimes I'll also sing and write songs by myself.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it keeps me stay creative. I think it's a good training as well. Especially provides a way of expression, I guess, because, if I start talking about science or astrophysics, most of the people would think too hard to understand. But music is more universal communication language, and that can bring me a very different world and make it easier to make friends.
I like how you put it there, that music is more universal than astrophysics.
Yeah, it's fun. Yes.
So, and you said you sometimes write your own music. Do you actually you write it out on the sheets and release it anywhere? How do you make your own songs?
I do make the real sound, and I once released it on a Chinese music website.
Oh, and how did people like it?
Yeah, I think for people, friends like it. And for people who have listened to it, maybe, yeah, they like it. My family likes it.
Oh, that's good, yeah.
Yes. Unfortunately, during the COVID-19, this website locked down. Oh. So my record was lost.
Oh, but no.
Maybe I can post this somewhere else.
Yeah. Do you do that often, or is it hard to find time for the hobbies right now?
I do that often during, I was a PhD student. Mm-hmm. Now it's harder because working pressure is high as a postdoc. But if I got time, I can still just record some songs, not writing my own, but just sing, help me feel relaxed.
Mm-hmm. We did kind of go over this, so it might be redundant, but when the professor that you met at a conference who invited you to apply for JAXA, what exactly was it that made you say, okay, JAXA is the place I want to go compared to, you know, any other institution in the world that you could have potentially applied to? Was there something about JAXA that you really liked more than most other institutions? Or?
Oh, yeah. First of all, the satellite itself was built in JAXA. Right. So you do get very close to the satellite team or science team. And another reason is that I found the Japanese scientists are trained in a very similar way as my background. So, you know, in US, usually they want to train experts. So people are very expert on one field. But mm-hmm. when I first talked with Mitsa-san, he told me that in Japan, they try to let people, or they try to train scientists in with different way. Like they do both instrumentation experiments and data analysis science. So I feel like in here, you can get a more complete training in terms of science, and that's very important. I did also get the same experience since I was a PhD student. So yeah, I think it will give us more chance because you need to learn wide and to think deeply. So I think it's always better to learn more.
I'm not sure, maybe Asia as a whole might be a bit more interdisciplinary with the learning than you might get in America, for example?
Maybe, but I don't know. As I said, when I was in US, I was just also a visiting PhD student. So I don't know what I would get if I become a postdoc. Mm-hmm. But
it's still hard to compare because the situation is so different in each of these cases.
Yes, but I guess it's also true that US tend to have experts who focusing on only one thing, and they do it really well. And that's also one way to succeed, I think.
But you prefer being able to focus on multiple areas at once.
Yeah, I want to be wide.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Is it more fun, more interesting, more opportunity for discovery?
I think so. Okay. Yes, and also another reason is that I have never been to Japan. So that's more unexplored part for me. So that's more, makes it more attractive.
So as compared to, I guess, applying for an institution in either China or America, where you had had some experience, a place in Japan was a chance to explore the unexplored. That's interesting.
Yes.
So I assume anyway that there are a lot of people who listen to these podcast episodes who take an interest into the fields of the guests we have on each episode. And I always like to ask if they have any tools or resources that they can recommend for people. Let's say, for example, a college student, a younger college student who does not have access to a lab or organization of their own or any high-powered tools, but, you know, wants to really get into, let's say, X-ray astrophysics or some branch of your field, for example. Would you have anything that you could recommend to them to use to either learn more about the field or to actually participate in the field in some way?
Yes. So actually, all the X-ray satellite data are public, and the analysis tools is also available for the public, for anyone to download. So if you want, you can download it from HISARC, NASA's website. And they also have a very simple instructions for you to install the software and all the data analysis tool. For example, for the Chandra Observatory and XM and Newton Observatory, or for Suzaku Observatory, they have the guidance to tell you how to process the data by yourself. So basically anyone can become an astronomer if you want, but you need to get the proper knowledge to understand what you are trying to analyze. So if you are a graduate or college student, I do recommend you to go consult any astronomer professors, you know, and I believe everyone should try to help you. Yes.
I hope so.
It's better to do the work under the supervision.
Mm-hmm. I guess this is one of those areas that would be bit more difficult to learn by yourself.
There's also a lot of campaign that want to involve the amateurs into the decent research. For example, I don't remember exactly the project, but at least there's some website to tell you in a very, very easy way how to identify an exoplanet, for example. And once you report that, they do record your contribution into a real science project, because some of the identification is very simple and basic. So you just need to learn very basic thing to identify, to make a contribution to a real science project. And I believe there's a lot of ways. And if you search on the website, scientists are also trying to make the research more open to amateurs.
So when you say that it can be simple and basic.
Yeah, looking at a picture to see this kind of picture is exoplanet and this kind of picture is not. And you need to just answer. It's like playing very easy little games and everyone can do that. And if you're involved, can make a contribution.
So you mean sort of like they probably receive some sort of basic training in being able to visually spot the difference between an exoplanet and not an exoplanet, and then
just identify the pictures,
and then I guess they use data from several people's answers to determine what one is probably an exoplanet, or is it the individual themselves
can tell, and they can report this thing
on
the website. So there can be interactive tools on the website, and I think it's very, very easy to access.
All right. And the HESARC, I think that's HEASARC, an acronym. that you mentioned earlier is the website from NASA. We can put a link in the show notes as well.
HISA integrated a lot of tools for different satellites. For each different satellite, you can download their software from their own website, but they're all open to the public.
So all the tools would be available through, yes, through there directly.
Right. So I can give you some name like Chandra. Chandra, C-H-A-N-D-R-A, is the NASA's observatory with the best spatial resolution. And XMM Newton is a satellite owned by ESA. And also Suzaku, launched by JAXA.
You can access the data from all of these?
Yes.
With ESA?
Oh, yes.
Great. And as well as the diagnostics tools.
Not from ESA. The downloading data is from their own official website.
Oh, okay. They will link you to all of those.
Yeah, ESA providing a universal tools to analyze the data.
That's great. I think we might have a lot of people checking that out after they're done listening to this. So they can just access that, look through the tools, and there might be a bit of a learning curve to try and figure out what you're doing, but
but if you try to learn from each observation, maybe they link the paper that has been published using the data set, so you can also just click the link of the paper and read what have been done with this data.
Thank you. That sounds like a great tool for people to try out. One question that I like to always ask the guest on the podcast is, if you suddenly had a near unlimited budget for a project that you wanted to do in your field, let's say you had $10 trillion, so not enough money to do pretty much anything that you could imagine, and you have to use it for the research, what would you want to do? What would you like to research or build potentially? And what would you want to find out from that research?
Okay, it's a very, very nice question. It's actually, we were being dreaming with my friends here in JAXA. So my background is developing cryogenic detectors, and his background is developing gravitational wave detectors. And we were dreaming that if we can combine the two different energy, to combine the two different technology and build a gravitational wave detector with cryogenic detector. And I think we can start it with a high frequency gravitational wave source. So for example, one of the source can be stochastic background from the inflation phase of the universe, and another possible source is the primordial black holes.
To build something that can look for both cryogenic and gravitational waves, and actually be able to look into, I guess, the time during the inflation of the Big Bang.
Hi.
What would you actually hope to learn from that?
You know, if we can detect this kind of signal, it's already a big discovery. Like a breakthrough. And those kind of thing, like the inflation, are based on the gravitational wave detection, helps us to test the general relativity. And that is foundation for the physics. So that can be very, very important thing. And the primordial black hole is also happening, conjectured for a long time, but we don't have capability of detecting that. So that help us to answer what the dark matter is. So, you know, some we don't know till now, we don't know the nature of the dark matter. Some of them are guessing if it is particles, and physicists are looking for the nature of dark matter via very different directions right now.
With this invention, you could most likely figure out what this dark matter is and
maybe not fully understand the question. That's too big, really too big.
But there would be a few Nobel Prizes.
Yeah, but if we can reach the sensitivity limit of that inflation background, that can be a big, big breakthrough already. It's extremely hard.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really faint, you know. You need extremely sensitive detectors. That's really, really hard.
All right. So let's, anybody, investors listening who want to make that happen, please feel free to help make the cryogenic and gravitational detectors.
Yeah, that's
interesting. An audacious goal there. I like that. Just one last question that I'd like to ask before we wrap up here. But do you have any sort of interesting fact, theory, suggestion, or piece of information, anything at all that you would like the listeners to think about after they're done with this podcast and just sort of say, oh, that's interesting, or oh, that's deep, or maybe something that they'd want to go out and tell a friend about?
Yeah, I think it's a very hard question to answer. So as a scientist, I think, yes, I started my career chasing for unknown. And so, yes, we all want to be interesting people. But during my way becoming more and more professional, I think it's harder and harder to be interested. Because once you got very familiar with something, you find it's not interesting anymore. And from my experience, whenever I found something I don't understand, that will become a moment I feel most interested. So I like challenge, I like exploring unknown, and I like to realize that I have a problem. So for anyone who are listening to this episode and who wants to become a scientist or just the interesting people, I would suggest you to be not afraid of exploring unknown. It can be in many forms, like going to a different places that you have never been to, do anything that you have never tried before. And yes, that I think that's the motivation make my life better.
It sounds like a good life lesson, you know, explore the unknown and embrace problems.
So oh, yes.
Not even just for scientists, but maybe anybody can really gain a lot from this. I think this is really good.
Yes. Okay, that's also the slogan of the JAXA. Explore to realize.
Explore to realize. That's
I like it.
That's also a good slogan, yeah. On that note, I guess everybody should remember, you know, explore to realize. And embrace those problems. I think a lot of people are facing a lot of problems. So just take those and think about how you can solve them and continue to explore and continue
being
to realize.
Positive is the most important part.
Yeah, be positive and continue to look for new ways to get through all the things you're doing and find new problems to take on.
That's the fun part of the life.
Yeah, it's a fun part of life, and both science and life. I think there's a lot of overlap there.
Yeah.
It's a great message, and thank you. Thank you so much for that. And
thank you very much, Nikaido-san.
Thank you for coming on today. Yeah, it was great talking to you, and I hope you have a great time at your new position, and maybe we can talk again in the future to see how it's going after you've started your new job.
Yeah, thank you very much. I hope I can meet more miracles in my life in the future. Thank you very much.